Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Rebecca Buckman of the Wall Street Journal. Today, nearly half of all privately held businesses in the United States are owned by women. These companies employ 19.1 million people and generate a staggering $2.5 trillion in sales. What's more, businesses owned by women are sprouting up more quickly than those at the rest of the nation. Between 1997 and 2004, the growth rate in the number of women-owned firms was nearly twice that of all firms, about 17% versus 9% for the nation as a whole. That's the good news. The bad news is that, as of a few years ago, less than 3% of women-owned businesses took in more than $1 million in revenue. That compares to just over 6% for companies owned by men. There are plenty of theories to explain why this is happening. One is that women-owned businesses may have a harder time working with large customers and suppliers, such as Fortune 1000 firms, who often already have established lists of vendors and suppliers that they know and trust. Another longtime barrier has been access to capital. Many women entrepreneurs don't have the same networks that their male counterparts do, and they may find it harder sometimes to raise the money that they need to grow their businesses. Finally, women, particularly those that have taken time out of the workforce to raise children, might in some cases lack some of the up-to-date industry knowledge that their more established competitors possess. So how do we solve this problem? Well, with us tonight are some people who I hope have some answers. We'll look to them for some clues about how women-owned businesses can get the marketing tools, financial support, industry contacts, and knowledge that they need to scale their businesses and boost revenues beyond that $1 million mark. So now I'd like to introduce our panel. Nell Merlino, to my left, is the founder and CEO of Count Me In for Women's Economic Independence. She's the creative force behind the Make Mine a $1 Million Business program to inspire 1 million women entrepreneurs to reach $1 million in revenue by the year 2010. I think we should also note that she created the Take Our Daughters to Work Day for the Ms. Foundation in 1992. Seated next to her is Julie Tucker. She's the co-founder and co-publisher of Smarts Co., which is a publisher of games and guides that make learning fun. Smarts Co. was founded in 2002, and in 2005, Julie and her business partner, Jennifer Elias, were selected as Make Mine a Million Award recipients. Next, we have Ingrid Merriweather. She's the president and CEO of Merriweather and Williams Insurance Services. In 1997, she purchased the assets of Arisco and formed her company. Now she oversees production, marketing, and corporate operations. Finally, Gwendolyn Wright is a small business consultant specializing in finance and strategic planning. She founded the Wright Consultants in 1995. Her mission is to help entrepreneurs work smart, improve their cash consciousness, and make more money, a goal of every business. So I wanted to start things off by getting Nell to tell us a little bit about her group Count Me In, as well as the Make Mine a $1 Million Business program. Can you just give us maybe a quick snapshot of what these groups are about and how they got started?
Sure, and I want to just say hi to everybody and thank you for coming out tonight. Count Me In was started in 1999 with the belief and the understanding that women were still challenged by getting access to credit and capital. And we were the first organization to make microloans available to women across the country using the Internet. And we've made loans to women in all 50 states. We've made close to 1,000 loans across the country. And in the course of doing that, we noticed something about women business owners, and about a quarter of the women who were coming to us had slightly larger businesses. They had more employees than the startup micro businesses, but they too were having trouble getting financing from commercial financial organizations. They, in some cases, had 10 to, 10, 14 employees. They were really growing. They would borrow $5,000 from us, give it back to us in 6 weeks, 6 months, and we'd, loan them some more money. Julie was one of those.
And they really did inspire us to think about what it was that was getting them sort of stuck, because they couldn't grow much more without more money. So we started to make larger loans, and at about the same time went to talk to Open from American Express and said, we're noticing this. And they at the same time told us that women with $1 million in revenue was the really sweet spot for them of people who had business credit cards. So we sort of looked at them and said, you know, do you want to help us make more women who have $1 million in revenue? And very quickly they responded that they wanted to. And we created this Make Money $1 Million Business Program, which very briefly supplies women with financing, marketing, and mentoring help. Women who get awarded in the program get up to $45,000 in a loan from Count Me In. This year they'll be getting a $10,000 line of credit from Open from American Express. They're going to get an incredible technology package from Cisco Systems, who's just joined us as a partner, as well as they get coaching and mentoring for a year. Because what we've found is that women really need some help figuring out how to negotiate and navigate getting these businesses. So Make Money $1 Million essentially is that. And last year was our pilot year. We had 23 winners. Julie was one of them, along with her partner, Jennifer. And our 23 winners so inspired us. They're from across the country, every kind of business that you could imagine. It inspired us to want to get 1 million women to $1 million in revenue by the year 2010. There was all kinds of evidence that suggests that there are actually women in the pipeline, but there are as many forces out there who don't believe there are 1 million women who can get to $1 million. There are major places who think that women have small businesses because they like having small businesses. That was the one that got me. That is what set me on this quest. Head of a major foundation who said, you know, we don't even want to finance women entrepreneurs because the conclusion we've come to is they like having small businesses. I like, boom. And we look at and are really encouraging women to have a much bigger vision for their business. I will tell you, the women that we awarded last year encouraged everyone at Count Me In to have a bigger vision. That's where we got to the million at a million. And the other thing that we've learned is that once women declare their intention to grow their business, it starts to grow. So any of you out here who are business owners, what we're out here talking to people about is getting your head straight and just going for it. Because if you go for it, you can do it. And I'll stop there.
Just one quick follow-up. So for this year's program, is there a deadline for applying, or can people still apply?
Yes, the deadline for applications, there is a wonderful event on June 2nd at the St. Francis Hotel, the Westin, you know, on Union Square. June 2nd, that's a Friday. And if you want to apply, the application is at makemineamillion.org, and we have leaflets and stuff that we can give you afterwards. The applications are due May 12th, and my partner down here at the end, Gwen Wright, if you need help with your applications, you know how to find. She'll let you know how to find her, because she can help you if you're having a challenge getting them finished. But May 12th, get them in, and if not, we're going to be doing it again in New York in October. So you got two chances this year if you're ready to grow your business, and if you're not ready, go to the website and declare your intention, because we want to create a big community of women to help each other.
All right. Well, Julie, as Nell mentioned, you were a winner last year, so obviously got some goodies out of that. So I do want you to tell us about what the award did for you, how it helped you grow your business. But before that, I have to tell you, when I found out I was going to do this, I went to the web and I looked up your website just to learn a little bit more about your company, and I was greeted with three big words on your homepage, which were food, wine, and sex. So can you just explain that first?
Yes, we try and catch your attention when you come visit us, and it's sort of the essence of our whole company is we make fun ways to learn about what we call life's greatest pleasures, which are obviously wine, food, and sex, and soon to be baby and dog. You know, you have a couple glasses of wine, you get a little sex, you have a little baby. But no, they're fun question and answer cards that you can play in the car, on the plane, over dinner, and you can learn about things interactively with your friends and family. And we started in 2002 with Wine Smarts. That's been a huge hit. It's been, you know, loved by top chefs like Mario Batali and Thomas Keller. And we should, by the end of this year, have 17 products out. And they're just, I mean, if you want to learn about wine in a very, or food, or chocolate, or coffee, or babies, in a really unintimidating, fun way, go to smartsco.com. So that's my company. But I'm here to talk more about business and being in business. And it's so inspirational to have now. Like, they talk about these elements of the Make Mine a Million program, but we get to see Nell every so often, and that gets me excited. You know, sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm tired, you know, and having Nell and seeing her inspire us and you know, push us up. And it's been an awesome year so far. And we've been, so we were selected in August. We went down to, we filled out the application. We weren't really sure what it was. Someone told us, you know, we were in the $5,000 micro-landing program, and someone from Count Me In, we didn't really know them very well when we were in the small, in there, and they said, you know, you need to apply for this Make Mine a Million thing. We said, oh, okay, sure, I'll, you know, I'm sort of strange. I like to do business plans. So I thought that was fun. You know, I'll fill out the business plan. And we applied, and they invited us down to Long Beach. So I flew down there, and it was this sort of American Idol-style program where we had 4 minutes to tell everyone about our company. And then there was, like, voting and judges. And, you know, you're really scared, and you're like, you really want this. I really wanted the $45,000. And the coaching and mentoring, oh, yeah, that'd be nice, too. Whatever. Yeah, okay. And but the $45,000 actually is the least important thing, I think, of this program. The coaching, the mentoring, the connections, the inspiration is so critical. And how it's changed our lives is, before it was just Jen and I, and we're a partnership, at least we have each other, but a lot of women are out there, you think you're on your own, but there are so many people out there that are there to support you. There's corporations like Open by American Express who put us in their TV commercials, you know, and there's Nell, and there's all sorts of networking programs that we really didn't access. We're like, oh, we're too busy to do that. I'm too busy to join that club. I'm really too busy to go to that networking event. That's not going to be useful of my time. But that is the most important thing, I think, to do, and to get that coaching and to reach out. And we have official coaches and mentors through the program, but then we're reaching out to even more people, and our network is expanding, and we're growing our organization that way. So I think in a nutshell, that's really where I feel we're learning.
Okay, very good. I wanted to ask Ingrid next. We've talked a lot, obviously, about the upside of this program and the resources that are available to women. Ingrid, your business is now very, very successful. Meriwether & Williams is the largest, I believe, woman and minority-owned insurance firm on the West Coast, or insurance brokerage. But I have to think it wasn't always that easy, and you certainly faced some obstacles early on. Can you maybe just talk about a couple specific examples of those and maybe some lessons learned from those?
Sure. Well, first let me kind of clarify that although we are the largest minority and woman-owned insurance brokerage firm in the West Coast, what's telltelling about that is that that's our status with just 22 employees. So that tells you the void or absence of women and minorities in our industry. And if you think about the insurance industry, I mean, it's humongous. And for us to be able to claim that status is actually, although we feel positive about being in that position, it's also telltelling about where we're absent in our industry. So that kind of begets the obstacles that you can imagine we encountered as we started to promote our business after I acquired it. What was kind of the typical challenges is accessing capital and cash flow, which Gwendolyn will probably speak more to, but also just really digesting the ruthlessness of our competitors in their efforts to try and diminish our qualifications and competency. And the fact that we were considered a threat by companies that were truly a billion times our size was something that kind of took me off guard. And I don't have an innate sense about me to be dogged and to ridicule or criticize others as a way of trying to promote myself. So that took some getting used to. What we realized that made us a threat to our competitors was the fact that we particularly do a lot of business with public entities and take advantage of our unique status of being a woman and minority-owned business. And so even though we were so small in comparison to our peers, they saw us as a threat because we had a strategic advantage that they couldn't claim. And so that took some getting used to, and we found ourselves both partnering with these firms as well as competing with them all at the same time. And but we kind of figured out the right strategies, and ultimately our work product and our reputation is what carried us through. And, you know, we're about to celebrate our 10th anniversary and have doubled the size of the company over that time frame. And we're particularly proud of the fact that a large segment of our business is really designed around helping other businesses like us access public construction opportunities. We run programs for public entities to help minority women and small contractors access bonding and credit necessary to bid and serve public contracts. And in 11 years, we've helped facilitate about $150 million in contracts for other businesses like ours, and it's helped grown our own business in the process. So we're kind of like a triple bottom line company in the sense that we're growing as a result of our efforts in helping other people grow.
And what about your record of, you mentioned you serve a lot of public entities. I think I've read that one indicator of a successful woman-owned business or one that might have a chance to get more than $1 million in revenue is how many large customers that business has.
Right.
I think only 4% of the spending by Fortune 1000 companies is done with woman-owned businesses. What have been the challenges there for you?
So are you talking specifically the private sector or just...
Talk both, yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, in the just to contrast, in the public entity environment, for the most part, although these kinds of opportunities are starting to diminish, but most public entities include utilization of small minority and women-owned business or disadvantaged mm-hmm. business enterprise in their procurement and contracting goals and objectives. So, you know, my recommendation is you look for those kind of opportunities and exploit your uniqueness because, you know, others have advantages that we don't, the good old boy network, the long-standing relationships, the golf buddy thing. So really claim your uniqueness because it can be a strategic advantage. In the private arena, for example, we do business with The Gap, and that came about from a unique opportunity where The Gap was looking to build their new headquarters facility here in San Francisco. And it was a redevelopment project, which meant that they had to adhere to the city and county contracting goals with respects to participation by firms like ours. So we went knocking on The Gap's door and presented our qualifications, knowing that they were going to have to buy insurance as respects to this project. And if they bought it from us, they'd kind of get double bang for their dollar. And that just opened up the door, gave us an opportunity to demonstrate our capabilities. And that was, what, 7 years ago, and we've grown with new business opportunities as a result with them from that. So, but there are organizations like the Northern California Supplier Development Council, which is really made up of, 150 local corporate entities, your Safeways, your PG&Es of the world, that proclaim to want to do business with woman-owned businesses. And so it's important to become a member of those kind of organizations because and basically press the issue that they have meaningful participation. And it gives you the clout of critical mass, too. You're not just the only one knocking on their door. You've got 100 other women-owned businesses knocking with you.
Okay, great. Gwendolyn, I know in your consulting business, I think you told me you work with quite a few women-owned businesses, maybe 70% of your clients. What can you tell us about some of the mistakes they make when they're trying to grow their businesses? You mentioned to me, for instance, that some women seem to have an almost unnatural fear of numbers and financial statements, which may hurt them.
Yes, they do. First, I'd like to thank the Renaissance Center, my client, for referring me to the panel. And during the last 3 weeks, I was working with the Renaissance Center, hosting financial workshops on behalf of Count Me and Make Mine a Million. And that was, the workshops primarily had to deal with financial statements and financial projections and anything associated with finance. And one of the things that I've seen during my 10 years as a finance consultant is there's a lot of fear out there. I see some people nodding their heads in the audience. Fear of numbers, fear of money, fear of financial statements. And as a result, women are only 2.6% of businesses $1 million and more. I think this is critical for women to understand their financial position and, as I call it, their cash consciousness. I ask questions all the time. I say, especially now, how much money did you make the first quarter of 2006? And it's a blank stare. Or then I said, okay, well, how much money did you make in 2005? And there's another blank stare. To me, that's unacceptable, especially if you want to grow your business. If you just want to maintain your business, it's unacceptable. So one of the things that's very important for women on a daily basis to understand, how much cash do you need to keep your business up and running? How much cash do you need on a weekly basis? How much cash do you need on a monthly basis? How much cash do you need on an annual basis to meet your operating expenses, to meet payroll, to pay taxes? Of course, right now, April 15th has come and gone, and I know a lot of small businesses are feeling the crunch because all of a sudden they have a tax liability. And I talked to them and said, well, didn't we talk about this? This was coming up. This is something that you have to anticipate. So one of the things I want to share with you is some of the things that I would like you to just look at. For the businesses who are product-based businesses, I think one of the most important things for product-based businesses is to understand your profit margins. And that means understanding, number one, how much does it cost to produce, manufacture that particular product? What are the raw materials? What are the labor? I spoke to a business owner during one of the workshops, and it was on a one-on-one consultation after we had the workshop. And she was adamant that her cost of goods sold was 45%. She kept going over and over, and I said, okay, let's just calculate it. We calculated cost of goods sold for 3 years. It was more like 67%. Big difference, right? Mm-hmm. And that means she was not looking at her numbers on a regular basis. She did not know how to calculate it. And that's one of the things I see all the time. Women get financial statements, their accountant does it. They tell me I have a bookkeeper. They get the tax returns, and they put it away. And they never look at it again until they look for a loan. And then they pull it out, and they come to me with these financials, especially if they've been declined for a loan. So it's critical for you to look at your financial statements. That means a profit and loss statement, cash flow statement, and a balance sheet. The most important of all, I say, is the cash flow statement. That's why I talk about improving your cash consciousness, because cash pays your bills. It's not profit. Oftentimes when we want to say, oh, I have $1 million, we were back in the green room, and one of the things we talked about is making $1 million, and that's wonderful. But the higher goal is to have $1 million in net worth. Because you can have $1 million business. I see women who have $1 million in sales and they make $30,000. They have employees that make more money than them. Mm-hmm. They have $2.3 million who come through their business and they call me because they need a loan because they're not, you know, they don't have any cash flow and they're operating at a loss because they're not keeping track of those expenses. They don't keep track of the back door. So one of the things I was working on with one woman and just doing projections so she could apply for this is instead of $1 million, we're looking at $1.2 million so she can have a salary. Right? That's critical. It's very important. Are you getting paid? And operations. Also look at your expenses, your operational expenses. Understand what it costs just for your insurance and your taxes, those kinds of things. Understand what your marketing budget requires. Marketing is very expensive. Search marketing is very expensive. Networking is expensive. So budget. Understand the difference between a capital budget and your operational budget. Capital budget is for those big purchases, leasehold improvements, buying. If you're moving from, let's say, a $200,000 a year business and you want to grow to $1 million, you have to move. Hopefully, you'll need more office space, right? You'll also need more computers. So those are capital budgets. And then understanding what you're going to require just for your regular operating expenses. Because if you're running a $250,000 business or even a $500,000 business, what it takes to run that business is quite different than a $1 million business. One more fear I want to talk about. This is fear of debt, fear of credit. It's so interesting. So many women, even with this program, they're saying, okay, we're going to give you $45,000, and then we can give you between $10,000 and $100,000. And women will tell me, oh, I don't want it. I'm like, what? If you're going to grow your business to be a $1 million business, you need more than $45,000, guaranteed. The more you have to ramp up your business, the much more money is required. I said, you're going to need that $45,000, plus you're going to ask for more. You're going to say, I need $150,000, and maybe they'll get you that. in addition. So that's important. That's key. Men, on the other hand, they come marching to me, and they want as much as they can get. Mm-hmm. With no problem, no qualms. I had a woman who told me the other day, oh, I'm having cash flow problems. And I'm saying, well, what about your line of credit? She doesn't want to use a line of credit because of the interest. Right? I see a lot of nods. I'm like, well, you have to. That's why we have it. So you won't have cash flow problems. So it's all of those things.
All right, very good. I could throw this out to the panel. This is, again, something we were discussing earlier, and it kind of cuts to the heart of women's motivations for starting businesses. Do you guys think that women start businesses for reasons different than men, and does that impact how successful those businesses ultimately are?
I know we have a question on the Make Mine a Million application. We have about 400 applications in now, and one of the questions is, why did you start your business? And not one of the women has answered the question that they started their business to make money. Mm-hmm. They have started their business to do some very important things. Money is not everything, but the sooner you're clear about what you want to do with the money, the faster your business will grow, the sooner you will be less afraid of all the things that Gwen was talking about. They talked about getting greater balance between their work and their family life. They talked about being thrilled about being their own boss, mm-hmm. about making a great product, about, you know, delivering a service that no one's, delivered before. All of it about making the world a better place. And if you ask a group of businessmen if they think about any of those things primarily, they look at you like you've got three heads. And I think the important issue for women in business is to understand that we don't have to be exactly like men to be successful in business. Correct. That all of those things that we want in terms of balance with life, you know, and being our own boss and all those things are wonderful if we can marry it to the importance of and an understanding of our money.
Correct.
Then we really can go.
No, I agree. I think it has to do with financial independence. That's what mm-hmm. I talk about. How much money do you need to be really financially independent? Are you thinking about the amount of assets that you need for the future and being able to use those assets to get where you are, to get where you want to be? That's critical.
I'll speak for us. And we were absolutely in that group of, we started Smarts Co. because we thought a wine game would be really cool. And then, why don't we make it a big publishing company? And, you know, we sort of joked about our publishing empire, but making money wasn't a huge thought. I mean, it was, that would be cool. And, you know, hindsight being 2020, we did do a round of friends and family financing. And we just thought, we're going to raise as little money as possible, as much as we just absolutely need. And we wouldn't, you know, ask our friends and family for investment that would pay our rent, you know. So we're sitting there, not paying ourselves, and we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot. And, you know, if I've learned anything from Nell and Count Me In, it's like, you absolutely have to pay yourself. And when you make your business plan and when you make that intention to start a business, mm-hmm. you better have a plan on how you're going to pay your rent. And it could take years. And for us, it did take years. And, it gets really frustrating when you're not getting money out. And if you can find investors or lenders is hard. You're not going to get a lender to, you know, pay your salary so much early on. But if you're going to have that capital that includes paying your rent and all of your personal expenses for the foreseeable future, for at least a couple of years, I've never heard of anyone making profits shorter than a year. I mean, there's occasionally in a service business, but if you're making a product business, it's hard.
Julie, you mentioned your friends and family financing round. I mostly write about venture capital here in Silicon Valley and San Francisco. So I'm curious, did you ever consider venture capital? And does anyone else have any thoughts on that and whether it is still a little more difficult for women to break into that club?
I have friends that are venture capitalists. So here's what we're going to do. And basically what I've learned is venture capital revenue streams that just have a hockey stick. Mm-hmm. So essentially it has to be technology. So to have a product base that you're just growing on a regular trajectory just is not appealing to them. Angel funding is a different way to go. And they have lower expectations, but the venture people take high risk if they think there's a huge reward. Mm-hmm. But that was my experience.
Okay. And, everybody's talked a lot about networking and said that that's important. I have to think that's kind of challenging though, because there are so many opportunities, and I would think the challenge is picking the right ones. I mean, is there a strategy for networking that makes sense?
I have a motto. I do. Because I know you always do well if you go out. And I mean that for a lot of things. But this worry about, you never know who you're going to meet. One of the reasons we structure the Make Money Million program, where you have to give a 4-minute elevator pitch about your business, mm-hmm. is because there are opportunities around. I think you have to decide, you know, how many times a week you do this, or, you know, things like that, just to budget your time.
Sure.
But it is the women who come to us who say, and this is fairly typical, they get to about $250,000 in revenue, they stand before us and they say, I'm so proud, I did this all myself, and I did it all by myself, and I didn't borrow a penny. Mm-hmm. And the reason they're stuck at $250,000 is because they've done it all by themselves, and they haven't borrowed any money. And I'm not an advocate of borrowing money. You have to figure out how to leverage money somehow. Mm-hmm. And the reaching out to others, no one has ever built a huge business by themselves. Nobody's built a business really beyond $250,000 by themselves. Truly, you have to reach out to people, hire people, have advisors, you know, a network of people who you keep learning from and who keep doing the kinds of things that Ingrid was talking about that she's doing in terms of you know, getting other people, you know, once you get in the door. You know, years ago it was when women get in the door, they sort of close the door because they were the only one and they knew that there was only going to be one and it was them. Mm-hmm. Well, it's very different now, and we really need to help each other with this.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The other issue I thought we should discuss is role models, since we've talked about the importance of having more businesses that owned by women that, you know, have $1 million in revenue, or even, as Gwendolyn said, we should be shooting for $1 billion. Who are the role models in this regard? I mean, people, names that we know, but maybe also names we don't know, and what do you think they've done right and wrong that we can learn from?
I'll respond to that first, and I want to actually acknowledge the 100 Black Women organization who put my name forward for this event, who gave me an award last year for the Madam C.J. Walker Award. And not everybody is familiar with Madam C.J. Walker, but Madam C.J. Walker was really the first black female millionaire who, back in, I'm going to lose my history test here because I don't remember the actual time frame, but back when it was really unheard of, built a business creating hair care products for women of color. And what I find most inspirational about, not only did she become a millionaire in an era where, you know, being African American was something that barely even got you employment at a level of living at poverty, but she used her business to help uplift other women by giving them alternatives to being domestic workers, which were really their only options then, and brought them into their business as her salespeople. And, you know, in doing so, it's really what spurred her to build her business to scale, because obviously she had a lot of access to women who would much prefer that alternative to being a domestic worker. So I find her inspirational from that standpoint, that doing something positive for other people and having a successful business are not mutually exclusive, that you actually can do both congruently, and they're very supportive of one another.
Okay. What about other role models besides, we were talking about people like Oprah and Martha earlier, but there have to be others that aren't quite that wealthy, maybe.
Yeah.
There are so many women, actually, out there who, you know, Ingrid, Julie, what I find
is you've really got to look for women who have businesses either that you admire or that you're envious of. The envious ones are the ones that you're envious of. You really ought to go get to know and talk to them because mm-hmm. they've figured out some things. Because I have a saying, if you spot it, you got it. If it's something that they're doing, you really should go find out more about them, because I can just sort of go city by city almost. There's a wonderful woman out of Texas named Gay Gaddis who has the largest women-owned advertising agency in the country. She's built an extraordinary business, and now has 140 employees. And, you know, Dell's one of her biggest clients, and she built that from nothing. And they all, I think, at some point cross some thresholds that, you know, I don't think everybody gets to, you know, $140 million, you know, in revenue, but I think she thought big. Mm-hmm. And the thinking big is, I think, the one of the key tenets of getting bigger than you are is thinking about what that would be like, because the sooner you think it, the sooner you'll do it.
No, it's true. I was telling them in the green room about a client who was so afraid when I talked to them just about $100,000 in revenue when they were coming off of $25,000. And within a year, we were able to grow the business to $250,000. And now it's easy for them to get to $500,000, which they should be at next year, and $1 million in the next year. And one of the things I was reading in the magazine, I was saying it's Fortune Small Business, and of course they were talking about the good old boys, and they're looking at $1 billion. That was their goal. And one of the things that they talked about there was, number one, of course, keeping your eye on your cash flow, but it also talked about having mentors and being able to look at other people and talking to other people and having that network. That's important. People beyond you and your capabilities, because we have to reach. That's the goal, is to reach higher. Mm-hmm.
That's a really important point. I think, and having mentors and these, you know, people, and you don't have to know them. Like, I have cold called people, I don't even know who they are, and say, hey, you're in this industry, how'd you do that? You know, and you'd be surprised how many people are totally happy. And it's not just women, there's men out there that are thrilled to just spend half an hour. And when we started the company, we just called everyone that we knew and didn't even know and said, hey, you have a cool company. Can I talk to you for half an hour? And people are so happy to do that. Mm-hmm. And getting their advice, getting their words of wisdom is so essential. You are not on your own, and people are happy to help you.
But we've talked a lot about the resources that are available, trying to network, programs like NELS, going after government contracts, things like that. What if you had to think about the one resource that's not there that you wish there was more of, what would it be? I mean, or what's the biggest remaining gap, you think, that maybe a program or just women overall maybe need to fill to help the businesses grow more?
Well, the thing that I find disheartening sometimes is a lack of women's willingness to support other women. So, for example, you know, I happen to sell something that pretty much every business buys. Every business buys insurance. And so there was a period of time where we developed a marketing strategy to pursue other women-owned businesses, which would be a natural inclination, being that that's our own affinity group. But oftentimes, they were very resistant. There are still some attitudes that women who have been successful in their own businesses hold, that, you know, a woman can't serve them as well as a man. And even despite their own prominence in their own business, they still look suspect at other women businesses who approach them to offer them goods or services. And that's such a lost opportunity, because if we can network and support each other's businesses, it will help us build to greater scale. That then makes knocking off the larger, you know, businesses that much easier, because we've got more bread and butter businesses that keeps us going, keeps us able to maintain and build to scale. So that's the thing that I find lacking, even in the women organizations that are supposed to be about promoting, you know, mutual business opportunities for each other. There doesn't seem to be the true commitment to it.
I want to hear from some other people, but just to note, in just a couple minutes, we're going to go to audience questions. So if anyone wants to line up, apparently that's the procedure. So start thinking of your good questions for these guys.
I wish there were more women in banking. I think that would be much easier. I think that would be so important. I used to be a banker, and I see there's not as many in banking as there used to be. I don't know where they're going or what they're doing. Maybe they're just starting businesses. Could be. But I think that would be a lot easier for women-owned businesses because men do bond together. And they're the main ones who are in the area of finance. They're the biggest number of bankers. They're the VCs. They're the angels. So I think we need more women bankers. We need owning banks, not just the bankers, but I mean running it, owning it, CEO, president of the bank. Also more women who are the angel investors who are going to invest in other businesses, and more women VCs. I think that would make the world a better place.
I agree with that. I certainly think, and I just want to sort of throw this out to the audience, I think we have to be clearer, we women in business, about what we want from all the companies out there who want to do business with us. Because we have wonderful companies that support Make Mine a Million and Count Me In, and, you know, and they are constantly saying and letting us know what they have to offer, and we work with them to figure out how it really can be tailored to the needs of women in, as their businesses grow. And I think the clearer we can be about what it is that we need, our experience is that there are companies and entities and organizations out there who will respond. It's not always exactly as we want it, but the more we can be clear and get some of the barriers out of our own heads about what keeps us from growing and start being just very open and clear about what it is that we need, our experience is, and if we do this collectively, that companies like, you know, QVC, Open from American Express, Cisco, they want to respond. We're growing businesses like crazy. And we need to work with them so that we can do that with them because they want to help us. That's what I'm clear about. And the question is, how can we help them help us?
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to go to audience questions in just a second. But for the radio audience listening, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and we're talking with women entrepreneurs and mentors who are catapulting businesses to the next level. I'm Rebecca Buckman of the Wall Street Journal, and I'm here with Nell Merlino of Count Me In for Women's Economic Independence, Julie Tucker of Smarts Co., Ingrid Merriweather of Merriweather and Williams Insurance Services, and Gwendolyn Wright of the Wright Consultants. So let's go to audience questions.
Hi, my name is Nancy. I'm from Cupertino. My question is regarding what lessons can be learned that you have, which can also apply to social entrepreneurship. You talked a little bit about networking and supporting other women and being clear about what you need. Are there any other lessons to learn that might apply?
I would say the most important thing is, you know, as a social entrepreneur, any kind of What at the end of the day do you want to accomplish? Where do you want to get? I think the clearer, you know, be clear about what you want, but be clear about where you want to go. We get a lot of calls that Count Me In from women who've always wanted to start a business but don't know what it is. And it's a challenging conversation. Because, you know, and we have books we refer them to and things like that. I don't want, you know, and we're happy if you call. But it is, you know, you got to put a stake in the ground and sort of say, you know, you got to put a stake in the ground. You also got to be really flexible because business is like that. Life is like that. But I think for social entrepreneurs, for entrepreneurs in general, what do you see? Where are you trying to get? Because the clearer you are about that, the more likely you are to get there. So I would say that whatever you're thinking of doing or whatever you're doing, if your goal is clear, it helps people help you. I have hundreds of people come see me, and they have a conversation with me, and I'm like waiting to tell me, you know, like, where are you trying to get? What do you want? You know, and let me go into my Rolodex and see if I can help you. And they're like going all over the place. It's like, you know, have a plan.
Right.
All right. Other audience questions?
I think it was in the last year there was a front page article in the New York Times about this trend of women graduating from college who were getting advanced degrees but leaving those professions to become working parents, working mothers. Excuse me, not working mothers, but stay-at-home mothers. So now I know you've talked about this a little bit, but it would be really interesting to hear your point of view about women who are parenting and the tension between, I think Ingrid talked about this too, about the choices that women have to make as they grow their businesses and being mothers. So I don't know if any of you wanted to talk about that.
I certainly think a lot of the women that come through Count Me In are there because they've made a decision that the jobs that they had before they had their children don't really fit their lives anymore, and that they need to create something that makes it possible for them to be involved with their families on a day-to-day basis and, you know, make a living. So I think there is, I think there are very few women in the world who have the luxury of being able to stay home. I mean, you know, for all the stories that people write about that, you know, there's a percentage of people who get a chance to do that, and, you know, God bless them, you know, that they, that they figured out how to do that. Most of us don't have that option. We have to make money somehow and, you know, work and build a business if that's what we want to do. And I, in fact, think, I mean, one of the women in the Make Money a Million program, Amelia Case in Chicago, had a baby 6 months ago and will hit a million in June. So you can have a baby and grow your business is what I have figured out. It really depends on how you delegate and things like that. But it's, I've not seen, I mean, I see great opportunity for women with children with their own businesses. In fact, I would say it's a very positive.
What I'd add to that, too, is that, you know, Nell kind of already hit on this, that, you know, as an entrepreneur, you have the ability of creating the culture of your business and your work environment. And I know in our case, I mean, I've got three kids and still have a young child at home. And one of the things I do is I blend business and family together. So I might go to some kind of political event. I'll take my son with me. And the other thing that we do, because out of 22 employees, we have 20 women and two men. We and all the women, you know, we have like issues and, you know, finding time for self and all the rest of that. So we've actually been trying to embrace some of those things within the work environment. So every Friday, for example, our conference room turns into a yoga studio. And, you know, so we're able to support each other almost on a more holistic level, recognizing that, you know, if you're going to spend 40, 60 hours a week someplace, it can serve a purpose beyond just the job, and you can fulfill some, you know, of your other needs outside of, you know, making a paycheck. And as an entrepreneur, you have the ability of creating whatever work environment or setting that's nurturing to you and your employees.
I think
I was going to say, I've worked with two small business women, I think it was last year, and they were stay-at-home moms. But what they did as a result of being stay-at-home moms, they were, their children were driving them crazy. So as a result of that, they started a new business because they wanted a place to go with their kids outside of the home, and especially when there were rainy days. So they started a business where they're having a play dates inside where moms can come, or anybody who are caregivers, they can come by during the day and have a safe place inside where they can watch their children and have a cup of tea and not be, you know, not be at home and not go stir crazy. So that was a result of having children. It was a great thing.
That question, though, does raise kind of the broader issue, though, of, you know, societal expectations of women now versus in the 70s. I mean, I think if you had said in the 1970s, as this article was pointing out, that a woman who went to Harvard Business School would tell you candidly, well, no, in 5 years I expect to just stay home and have kids. I mean, that would have been inconceivable 20, 30 years ago. Well, I mean, do you guys see a shift in that regard? I mean, is that affecting women's attitudes about starting businesses? Or as Nell said, is it such a small number of women it's not really affecting?
There was an extraordinary article that I read recently about a woman in the 1970s who wrote a book to counter the books coming out by Gloria Steinem and all kinds of folks, essentially saying that being a housewife was the best thing that you could do. And she genuinely believed this. She was a mother, housewife, you know, and homemaker. She described herself. She talked about the joys of all that. She's recently written a new book because on her 40th wedding anniversary, her husband gave her a divorce. And she ended up having a whole new life where she ended up running to be the mayor of her town, but it took her a number of years to recover. And she's written this new book to sort of say to all the women that she wrote the book for in the 70s, that it, you can love being a homemaker and a housewife and all that stuff, but you better have some way to make money.
That is
because
an incredible story.
You can get a divorce in 40 years, 30 years, 20 years. And that's my thing. I mean, if you find a way to stay home for a couple of years, go for it. But at some point, you're going to have to be making money. I mean, you know, in rare cases, you're not going to. So figure out a way to have the life that you want to lead. Mm-hmm. It's really about that, not whether, you know, what's expected. How are you going to live the life that you want to lead? And you want to be out of the workforce for a while, you know, and when the kids drive you crazy, you want to go do something else. and create something for yourself that allows that. And that's the power of being an entrepreneur, if you've got it in you. Because you can create that for yourself. And that's what's just the coolest as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We go to the next audience question.
Two questions. First, if you have, in the rare case of a more qualified male applicant, how do you justify hiring a female? The second one is if you have $10,000, $100,000, or $1 million to invest in women enterprises, where would you go?
Okay. So the first question is about deciding about an applicant. I mean, I always look for the most qualified person.
Sure.
I think first and foremost, you look for the most qualified person. And I honestly can tell you that there are not a lot of men that apply to work at Count Me In for Women's Economic Independence. one of the questions we always get, one of the questions we always get is what happens if a man applies for a loan? And in the 6 years we've been doing this, two men have applied. Because, I mean, men have banks. And they have just other sources, but they also, I mean, so it hasn't been a big issue. But in terms of where to invest, I'm going to be a shameless promoter. Count Me In has a investment fund called Invest in Women Notes. Mm-hmm. To give you an idea, one woman from the Bay Area invested $1 million in the Count Me In. It's in our Invest in Women Notes program. In 2002, she has helped us start over 300 businesses with her $1 million investment. So there is a lot of opportunity, and there are many wonderful women-owned businesses who obviously are looking for investors. I mean, there are a couple right up here. So we could certainly let you know what they are, but there are a number of different ways that you could invest in women-owned businesses, which I'm happy to talk to you about.
All right, we finally have a cue. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Hello, my name is Nilu Savis, and first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for coming here tonight. It's been both informative and inspirational. I'd like to know what techniques you found to be most effective in marketing your businesses. I know you mentioned earlier about just get out there, and very helpful.
It's been networking. That when I first started, I think I was out there all the time. And one of the things that I do when I'm working with startup businesses is I give them assignments. And that assignment is to make sure that they're collecting at least 25 new business cards a week. So at the end of the month, they have 100. And then from that 100, what we're going to do with it. So I think being very strategic in networking is very important for any. I think we talked about that a little bit earlier, meaning understanding the target market that you're going after and making sure that target market is in the room. And the other thing, I, in order to save time, I always let them know. I said, you don't have to stay for the whole entire event.
Right.
You know, you can just be there an hour. You don't have to stay for dinner. You know, just an hour or up to 3 hours a week. I think that's critical.
For me, I think it's being creative about free ways to do it and finding fun partners and asking. And I'll give a little story about when we won the Make Mine a Million Award last year, and they said, oh, it's American Express, and it comes with marketing. And I said, you know, let's be the poster children for American Express. And I was kidding. But I said, you know, let me call the PR director at American Express. Just let him know of, you know, there's 23 award recipients. And just let him know that we're available to do, you know, talk about how great American Express has been for us. And which they are. I mean, I'm not lying. And so next thing you know, Channing invites us to this panel, this New York Times panel. And the next thing you know, the Ogilvy and Mather people, we have this ad campaign. We're going to put you in a photo. And they said, oh, well, don't get excited. We have this TV commercial, you know. And it's sort of just like, if you can envision it,
go for it. Like, dream it. Dream, like, we will be the poster children for American Express, and we are, you know? And I'm like, how did that happen? And we just, I said, let's do it. And just be creative.
I would echo Gwen's piece, really understand what your target market is. Most business plans that we get don't identify their target market. Spend some time. You can do informal focus groups. You can do all kinds of stuff. Understand who it is that you're trying to sell to, and then go after them, because you don't want to waste your time or your money.
Thank you.
One of the things that we've used pretty successfully is when you have a few successes and you have clients who are happy and satisfied, they're great ambassadors for your business, particularly when it's other women who can appreciate, you know, what you're trying to accomplish. And so we use client testimonies a lot. I mean, we'll have a client write a letter, you know, proclaiming our wonderfulness, and we'll just take excerpts out of the letter and throw them around here and there in proposals or whatever, and that's something that we use and doesn't have a cost associated with it. Then creative branding. We're actually working with a consultant now to do a new brand strategy for the company. And, you know, don't think that public relations and working with a graphic consultant and doing brand development, that's not just analogous with large companies. As a matter of fact, small companies can greatly benefit from utilizing those kind of resources, and they aren't necessarily all that expensive because there are other small businesses who are in that field. Mm-hmm. So we have a graphic designer we're working with now who's one of the incubator businesses out of San Francisco Renaissance, doing a tremendous job for us at a very affordable cost. So think about public relations. Think about... I know of another business that's 10 employees, and they have a director of communications. I mean, you would think this is AT&T, but, you know, communications is absolutely critical to market your business and get the message out there. So kind of look what big businesses do and then scale it down to your budget and your resources, but obviously it's got proven results in being effective.
Okay, I think we have time for a couple more questions.
Thanks. Hi. My name is Jane Lurie. I'm with ProMedia Coach, and I think I come from a different situation than a lot of the people who I see around me, because my partner and I spent many years in the corporate world developing our skills and our talent. So we came knowing how to do the business that we do. What we didn't come knowing is how to do business. And so you said, you know, you love to do business plans. Would you like to join our business? Because, you know, I'm terrified. You know, we actually did apply for the, you know, Make Mine a $1 million business. And we had to, you know, do things that were terrifying for me. And we do, we got somebody, something called conscious bookkeeping. We got a conscious bookkeeper to help us set up our books. And so I have QuickBooks. But it still is, makes my heart thump when I sit down to write a report. So do you have...
maybe tips for overcoming that? Is that what you're...
Yeah, and resources, someone to kind of focus, you know, the...
You
whole
really
got to
think about where it's going to get you. Because I appreciate the fear. But if you step back for a minute and think about what you're afraid of...
Right.
Success.
Would you ever take a trip somewhere and not plan it?
No,
you wouldn't. Right? Come on, look at me. You wouldn't.
You know what I think.
And if you stop seeing it abstractly as business planning and you know numbers and all that stuff, and it is, you know, because you know your craft and your skill, and it's encasing it in some direction with that you get to decide. It's not as if I am convinced that some of this is the belief that somebody is imposing this on you from somewhere else. It's as if by filling out the application somehow that I've imposed this order on you. They're just some logical questions that if you answer them, because didn't you find it interesting as you were answering them?
No.
Didn't you learn an enormous amount answering them?
Right, and focused. But, you know, what I'm talking about is the resource to say how, you know, how to interpret, you know, what is a balance sheet? You know, how to
interpret. It takes time. You know. It takes time. I mean, I could work with you. I work with small businesses who have no clue, and I see the light turn on, all of a sudden they get it. And it's another language. That's what it is. You know, reading financial statements is reading, it's another language. And what they do, they tell you a story about how you're managing your business. I can take 3 years or 2 years of financial statements of any business in here, and I can tell you how you've run your business because the numbers tell a story. And it's not difficult at all for anyone to understand what that language is saying.
Well, I think this is so important. So many people that are in the Make Mine a Million Award, the program, when we were at this conference last November, everyone was like, I'm a corporate refugee. I mean, we all are. We all want to get out of the corporate world. We want to have flexibility. I mean, that's the truth. And, you know, I got my MBA. I took all those classes about financials and all that. That doesn't translate into small business.
Right.
What you're learning in corporate stuff is very different, but it's the same essentially. You just have to bring it down a level, and now you know. Like I studied all this stuff, but now I really know what finance is. Now I really know what accounting is.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes experience. But there's workshops. There's books. Take a class on accounting. I can't emphasize that enough. Knowing your numbers is I can't emphasize it enough.
And what happens? I see the fear can dissipate if you do it on a regular basis.
Yes.
If you look at those financial statements every month religiously for a year, I can guarantee you by the end of that year, it's no more fear. You understand it. And then intuitively, you begin to understand what's going on. And I've worked with businesses. They may not know everything going on, but they will intuitively know things that are wrong when they're looking at every line item that I'm pointing out. And sometimes it takes a little hand-holding, which is okay, but you have to do it.
And don't let your bookkeeper do it.
Okay.
You know.
I'm hoping to squeeze in that one last question, and then I think we've got to stop.
And we'll be around afterwards.
Yeah.
Scare you some more. I'm only kidding.
What about the fear in service industries of losing the quality of work? I'm a consultant to the arts, and my name and my service are consulting. I have employees, but when I think about that next big growth, it just terrifies me that I can't guarantee that the quality will still be there. How do you do that in service?
You know, women are natural-born nurturers, and what I find is that it's just intuitive for us to ensure that whoever it is we're serving at the time is taken care of, whether that's your child or your husband. That translates to your clients and your customers, and it doesn't matter if you went from 10 customers to 100 customers. It's just intuitive for us. And so I think, you know, it's an unnecessary fear. You will find the resources to make sure that when, you know, the sale is done and you're servicing the client, that client is client number 100 is as satisfied as client number 2 was. Don't worry about it. It will just happen. It's innate.
I want to comment on this, and it's trusting in your people, trusting in yourself to grow your people and to share that information. And in fact, if you get the right people around you and you give them the creative option, they're going to make it even better. You know, we've brought on some great staff members that have really challenged us to take ourselves to the next level. And with a consulting service, that's the same way. It's like, yes, what you do is good, but then trust in people to make it even better.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's all we have time for. Let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts. All right. So now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Okay.